the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we are going to analyse the main takeaway points from the New Zealand-Australia leaders bilateral meeting this week. And we will also consider how Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison referenced the ANZUS alliance while New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern spoke of New Zealand's defence requirements as an independent consideration. So who is correct here? Does Australia and New Zealand's restated commitment to being a trans-Tasman family drag New Zealand back to supporting future Australian conflicts? And are we hanging on Australia's defence coattails, as some media and the Australian fraternity would like to suggest? We're also going to consider China's response to this Australia-New Zealand bilateral and whether the People's Republic of China's dominating influence in Australia and New Zealand politics has reached its zenith. For example, does Australia and New Zealand government's renewed sense of self-identity identify a rebalancing of the regional and global order in some ways? And does the People's Republic of China's increased authoritarianism at home and abroad reflect leadership weaknesses rather than strengths? And then right at the end of the program, we'll start to discuss Israel. We will discuss the latest from the Middle East. There's a cobbled together coalition of anti-Netanyahu politicians, and they have succeeded, they say, in creating a new Israeli government. They've spoken to the president and they're claiming that they have the numbers. So how stable will that be? And what does this mean for Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza? Okay, so let's cross to Paul now and we'll discuss all of these issues and probably a lot more too. Good afternoon, Paul.
Tēnā koe, Matua Selwyn, and kia ora to all our listeners at home and abroad.
Well, you're taught te reo. It's really, really impressive, Paul. Tēnā koe to you. And it's great to have you on the program again. Ka pai, ka pai. Paul, let's look at the Australian and New Zealand, or the New Zealand-Australian bilateral meeting, the leaders' summit that occurred over the weekend and into Monday this week. What were the main points that you identified in this that stand out? We can get to the defence elements after your summary of commitments here, information here.
Well, I thought it was a well-orchestrated display of unity within difference. And by that I mean, there's very clear that in the bilateral relationship, there are significant differences over a number of policy areas. The one that immediately comes to mind is the deportation from Australia of New Zealand-born criminals who are returned here even though they lived their entire lives in Australia and are causing problems, you know, in large measure once they get back to New Zealand. There was no resolution of those differences. But when it came to external parties, the People's Republic of China specifically, there was a tremendous display of unity. Unity based on shared values, unity based on the fact that for all its flaws, Australia and New Zealand are both liberal democracies. And so I thought it was well done, and the proof of it being well done comes in who was annoyed by the outcome. Those who were annoyed were the conservative media and commentators in Australia and New Zealand, who wanted New Zealand basically to toe the line that the hard line that the Australians have drawn with regards to China, to just basically copy the Australian lead, and they didn't get that. And then, of course, the Communist Party of China, which was extremely annoyed at both countries, you know, got into bullying and blustering mode in response said that the joint statement, and I can see the response now, was interfering in their affairs and the like. So if one measure of success is the reaction of people who oppose you, then this bilateral conference between the prime ministers of Australia and New Zealand was a success. And I think it reaffirms one of the enduring strengths of democracies is that you can have very raw differences on certain policy areas, but when it comes to the fundamentals of principle and values, there's where you see the unity, even though the specific approach of each country's based on their geopolitical position, based on their domestic politics, may differ in its practicalities, if its tactics, if you will. And that's what we see here with Australia and New Zealand. They're on the same page when it comes to China. They just got to play their particular sheet of music in slightly different tones, given that the countries are very dissimilar in many respects.
Yeah. Paul, one of the things that stood out to me too was this reference to ANZUS. Now, most New Zealanders that lived through the 1980s and in through the 1990s and took a political interest, they couldn't escape the reality that New Zealand was expelled from ANZUS. That their ANZUS is not just a grouping of friendly nations that do perhaps military exercises as New Zealand takes part in today, but it was an alliance. An alliance Ford commits New Zealand to conflicts, particularly with Australia and in some conditions with the United States. Now, for the Australian Prime Minister to mention New Zealand and its defence policy and relationship with Australia by using the word ANZUS raised many eyebrows here in New Zealand. Likewise, with the with Jacinda Ardern, the New Zealand Prime Minister, she made reference to New Zealand's defence policies and defence engagements as being motivated by the country's self-interest, its national interests, its defence requirements from an independent nation point of view. Where is the common ground between those two elements, Paul?
Well, I think the way to look at it is that certainly by the end of the 1990s, and definitely after 9/11, the defense relationship between New Zealand and Australia tightened considerably, as did the defense relationship between New Zealand and the United States. No formal alliance was reconvened, but the partnership has been strengthened considerably. And let's also recall that the intelligence sharing arrangement under Five Eyes never really changed. There was some sore points in the late 80s and early 90s, but given the multiple common threats that the Five Eyes partners share, they were pretty much back to normal by the end of the 1990s. And now, of course, they're extremely tight on all levels. So I would think that the way to look at it, and if I was, the head of defense of these countries, is twofold. With regards to Australia, New Zealand can be seen as a force multiplier for the Australian military in specific instances of common interest. So New Zealand will not follow Australia every place it goes, because the Australians often follow the United States every place it goes. But they will supplement Australian military assets where needed, when needed. On the other hand, New Zealand is much more Pacific oriented. And so New Zealand's peacekeeping orientation, its very strong strategic interest in the island Pacific, as opposed to Southeast Asia, which the Australians look at much more strongly than we do when it comes to defensive purposes, that's where we split the difference, if you will. But we also need to think that the Australian military is an expeditionary force. It's designed to fight foreign wars. It has a lot of offensive weaponry. It's on its way to becoming at least a middle military power in the Southern Hemisphere, and I would argue within 20 years, 25 years, Australia will be a regional great power, militarily wise, if not economically. New Zealand is a defensively configured force. That's why it has that peacekeeping orientation. It's not configured, other than its special forces, to go abroad and fight sustained conflicts. It's simply not configured for that. So we tend to look, we being in New Zealand, tend to look at the use of the military near to our shores and in a more civic-minded capability. So disaster relief, search and rescue, where there is conflict, then definitely the peacekeeping comes in. And we contribute to the United Nations, you know, to peacekeeping efforts around the world. New Zealand has troops in the Sinai Peninsula, among many other places. So the force structure, if you will, of the two countries is quite different, but in a complementary way. And then their geopolitical perspectives reflect their aspirations. The Australians have global aspirations. We have regional aspirations.
Mm. So if we just, at this point, we'll break to bringing up what Jacinda Ardern said at the media conference that followed the bilateral meeting. You've got Scott Morrison, the Australian Prime Minister, standing right next to her, and you've got Australian media putting questions to her. You'll pick up immediately that it's about whether or not New Zealand is pulling its weight. Her response, and then if we come back from the back of that, and I'll talk to you about your analysis relating to, is New Zealand pulling its weight?
Mm-hmm.
As a proportional percentage of its GDP compared to Australia. So let's just play this.
...on Australia and others for defence and intelligence sharing. And is that why you appear to be cozying up to China? And Prime Minister Morrison, would you say that's a fair description of the situation?
If I had the ability, I would ask for some examples or evidence of the claim that you've made, but you've already heard me speak directly and strongly to refute the assertion that we are doing anything other than maintaining a very principled position on human rights issues, on trade issues as they relate to China. And in fact, I think you'll find very little difference in many of the messages that we've been sending relative to Australia. So that would be my first point. On the question of whether or not we rely on others, you know, in our view, in my very strong view, we carry responsibility for ourselves to ensure adequate investment in our defence forces, and equally that we carry our weight as a member of the intelligence and security community. Having said that, we have always operated at a regional level where we support one another. There will be parts of the Pacific for whom we will be, for instance, better placed to engage in search and rescue, to engage in fisheries monitoring, to engage in monitoring trade sanctions than Australia, and vice versa. We work together, but I reject any suggestion that we don't carry and deliver on our behalf and towards the international community.
So, Paul, I let it run its course there too so that people could pick up the whole context. And that clip was from SBS News in Australia, which is one of the more balanced, I would say, outlets in Australia. So picking up on what Jacinda Ardern was saying there, she's saying we're pulling our weight, our priority settings are aligned to our national interests as an independent country. I suppose I'm paraphrasing there, but that's pretty accurate to what she was saying. Remember to our audience here that the Australian Prime Minister was packaging his view of the relationship as ANZUS. So if we're getting back, the main point, Paul, is New Zealand, is it carrying its own weight with respect to its defence interests?
Well, let me first say that sort of inane question is what gives the media a bad
name. Not from
name.
Me, from the Australian right-wing press. Yeah,
from the female reporter. I mean, that was just inane. Here's the hard facts. New Zealand, interestingly, under Labor, since this Labor-led government has come in, has increased the defense budget by 19%, from 1% of GDP in 2016 to now a little bit over 1.5% of GDP. That is in line with most NATO countries, in spite of the Trump call for 2% of GDP to be put into defense. The majority of NATO spends around the 1.5 mark. So we're right in line with large countries in Europe who have far more pressing security concerns than we do. And we're in line with countries like the Philippines, which has not one, but more than one active insurgency in their archipelago. So they're fighting, you know, small fires all over the archipelago. They spend 1.5%. The Australians spend 2.1%. And that's only been over the last few years, but they're in the process of a major military buildup. Now let's think about where we put our money, because this idea we don't carry our weight, well, that's exactly where we put our money, given the defensive configuration of the armed forces. We have ordered new C-130 aircraft to replace the aging fleet they have, 8 of them. We have ordered 4 P-8 maritime patrol aircraft. They're also anti-submarine, but these aircraft are used for, again, fisheries enforcement, search and rescue, those sort of things. Both of the New Zealand frigates are being upfitted in Canada to make them compatible with their regional partners, i.e. the Australians and the United States, with the latest technologies. So the fact is sure, we're not buying F-35s and other offensive weaponry, but we're increasing our logistic capabilities so that we can move equipment and troops better, quicker, and extend our reach when it comes to patrol in our region in a measure that we couldn't do before. So again, we're configured differently. We look at the world differently in some respects. And we're putting the money into the areas of priority that the New Zealand Ministry of Defense and the heads of the military services have identified as areas of priority. So the whole argument, and again, this is more of a media beat up than a legitimate claim by the government of Australia, but the argument that somehow New Zealand isn't carrying its weight is both specious and it's wrong.
Yeah. With respect to Jacinda Ardern's point that New Zealand's defence configuration, and you've highlighted many of it just in your comments just then, is that complementary to the Australian effort? If Australia's defence interests are forward moving, aligned around attack type strategy and tactics, and supporting that, does New Zealand's defence hardware, if we put it in that way, and its skilled personnel, complement, as Jacinda Ardern would say, or is it quite a different alignment? That our interests in the Pacific, and remember for those that listen to this abroad, New Zealand's role in the Polynesian side of the Pacific is very much like perhaps the United States with respect to the Caribbean and the force of Mother Nature coming across at different times and it having to respond in relief efforts there. So does New Zealand, has it got it correct here, Paul? Or are there areas of deficit where New Zealand needs to, one, address, like it seems to be with respect to its relief efforts, but also if it is serious and committed to supporting Australia in conflicts of which it may find common ground on, are we adequate there?
By and large, yes. I mean, we have to remember that for partner militaries, interoperability is the key word. That is, if you've got infantry soldiers fighting shoulder to shoulder, let's say in, you know, the jungles of Papua New Guinea, they're going to have equipment that is compatible. I mean, it may literally come down to a case of throwing a magazine of bullets from an Australian to a New Zealand soldier under fire. And so you don't want to be fumbling around with different types of equipment under such circumstances. Now, New Zealand's not going to be purchasing a submarine anytime soon. But in the areas where it's foreseeable, let's say special forces operations around the world, The equipment used by both countries tends to be similar. There's, of course, always variations. And I should point out that New Zealand buys Australian equipment as a matter of course. So, the interoperability issues between Australia and New Zealand are not that concerning, given the circumstances in which the troops of both countries would find themselves together in a conflict theater. Obviously, the bigger ticket item you go, fighter aircraft we don't have, that sort of thing. Then you start seeing the differences. But even there, we ordered these P-8s, which are the upgraded version of the old P-3s. The Australians have put in an order for P-8s, more in number. But there, they can do joint patrols and they'll have the same equipment. So by and large, they're playing off the same page. I will say this, if there's any criticism to come about defense in New Zealand and its relationship with the Australia, the criticism should come from the left, because the pacifist left, and we have a strong pacifist movement here in New Zealand, undoubtedly are unhappy that we're now putting 1.5% of our GDP into the military rather than into schools and hospitals. And so I'm prepared to accept the critiques from the left, which I think are honest and based on good faith. I'm not prepared to accept critiques from the right, because the fact is they're just trying to drive a wedge into a gap that really doesn't exist. And here's the ultimate irony. The major increases in defense spending in New Zealand in the last 20 years have occurred under Labor governments, not under national-led governments. So the center-right and the right in New Zealand, which is supposedly all about defense and security, have actually underfunded the troops they claim to support, and the so-called socialists and commies in the labor-led coalitions have increased defense and its capabilities in real time every time they've been in office.
So let's move then on to the People's Republic of China's response. And let's have a look at this. Here's the joint statement that New Zealand and Australia jointly put out. And as you can see from the scroll here, it is quite a lengthy one. And one of the areas that the Chinese, or China, had issues with is near the bottom. Not to exclude global trade and New Zealand's support for Australia's interests in that area. But paragraph 42, the Prime Minister's expressed serious concern over developments in the South China Sea, including the continued militarization of disputed features and an intensification of destabilizing activities at sea. And they went on. The Chinese Foreign Minister honed in on that, along with the criticisms on China's human rights abuses toward the Uyghur people, and also the moves against the democratic elements in Hong Kong. China responded on all three points, but with the South China Sea, it seems, quite a considerable weight of response in its own statements relating to that. Many are saying, Paul, that there isn't anything new with respect to what New Zealand has said in this joint statement. Likewise with Australia, there isn't anything new in this that Australia hasn't already voiced. So one would take from it that the People's Republic of China is taking exception to Australia and New Zealand singing off the one sheet. What do you take from it? Do you believe that the People's Republic of China was compelled to make this particular response? Or do you believe that it is trying once again to drive a wedge between the two countries, as Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison actually alluded to?
The fact is that all that conservative barking about New Zealand not holding its weight and getting soft on China played into the Chinese hands. That's exactly what the Chinese wanted to see in a divide and conquer strategy. They wanted to see a rift between Australia and New Zealand, not a united front, to use the Chinese phrase. And so when instead they get a unifying document when it comes to issues Chinese, then they turn around, the Chinese Foreign Ministry, and they go into barking mode. And I say barking mode because this wolf warrior diplomacy is a bit nuts. I mean, let's be clear. Perhaps in Mandarin, the phrase wolf warrior means assertive foreign policy. But something's lost in translation. And in English, it sounds sort of mad, where they're going to get all fierce on anybody who criticizes them, even from a distance. But, you know, nothing's changed when it comes to the absorption of Hong Kong way before the 2047 devolution deadline, when it comes to the basically cultural genocide of Uyghurs, and I don't use that word genocide casually, when it comes to the flouting of international law in the South China Sea, again, based on the respect for international norms rooted in common shared liberal democratic values, there is no gap between how Australia views the Chinese and how New Zealand does. It's just that New Zealand, being a far more vulnerable country in many respects, has to tread a little more lightly than the Australians have. And so the Chinese were undoubtedly very displeased to see this statement, basically the statement of unity. And they responded as they have now for several years in a sort of bellicose, angry fashion that, quite frankly, is very undiplomatic of them and shows a certain immaturity when it comes to criticism that a great power simply should not have.
So, with this comment, I'll just bring back up on screen, actually, and it's the last part that the People's Republic of China's foreign minister actually spoke to. And I've got to say that this was in response to questions from Bloomberg. And the foreign minister says, "We once again urge relevant parties to stop making irresponsible remarks and act in ways that are conducive to bilateral relations and regional peace and stability, other than the opposite." With this, what does this signal to you, Paul, of what is happening within the People's Republic of China with its leadership, from the point of view that it has endured 2 years plus of trade wars under the United States Trump-led administration, that not a lot in that respect has changed with respect to the Biden administration, that China had, as Trump created a vacuum in the geopolitical stage, China moved in into that space as a significant global partner, a power. Does China sense when New Zealand and Australia, small players in the global scene, although burgeoning on regional power with respect to Australia and a small power with respect to New Zealand, but when they start talking outwardly, openly and jointly with criticisms of the People's Republic and it forces a response like this, does this indicate that the People's Republic of China's leadership actually senses that it's reached its zenith of influence, that it has had its opportunity to assert strong, compelling global influence, and that the United States is on its ascendancy and China is losing influence and perhaps respect amongst its closest trading partners within the region?
Well, that's interesting. I don't think that the United States necessarily will recapture its former position as a dominant superpower in the world. I think it's on the decline. I'd hate to say it for my American friends. It'll be a great power in a constellation of great powers for the foreseeable future. And you and I have talked about the emerging multipolar contours of the international system. But I think that it is right that China may have reached its high water mark, and that it appears to have overreached across the world. You see, Australia, for a relatively small country, has led the charge, the pushback against Chinese behavior. And it did so particularly because of Chinese so-called influence operations inside of Australia, putting money into politicians' pockets, influencing business decisions, direct overt interference in the internal politics of Australia with the goal of undermining Australia as a liberal democracy. And it's done that here. And the leaders of both countries have realized the Chinese don't play by the same set of rules, that bringing them in to the community of nations through institutions like the World Trade Organization, the World Health Organization, has not produced the results that were desired. You know, they haven't been, quote unquote, civilized. And I understand that that's a Western term, but the Chinese simply play different. And quite frankly, often they play dirty. So you're now getting this backlash. And I would argue, and again, this is a bit of a counterfactual, that the overreach that we have seen, I mean, if you think about the fact that China is picking fights with India in their disputed border regions, that China has annexed territory in Nepal, recently discovered through satellite photography, and then it's engaged in a number of other ventures that violate international law and that sort of thing. Doing all of that simultaneously suggests to me that within the Communist Party, and particularly with regards to President Xi Jinping, this is overcompensation for self-perceived weakness of one sort or another. And I'll give you an example.
Yeah, and then we'll get to
it. It may come to light that the COVID virus did come out of a lab. Now, I don't think it was deliberate. I don't think that, you know, there was any orchestration of the disease. I think that they had found strains of this virus. They were looking at it at their specially designated lab, and as often happens with facilities that are not hyper-secured, the virus leaked out.
Yeah, but that seems to be a developing narrative on it, doesn't it? That it's not necessarily malicious, but they were testing something that was new and it's escaped.
Right. And so here's the thing. A strong leadership of a great power would recognize, okay, we had an accident. This thing is out. We got to get on top of this quickly. And so we need to inform the public. We need to inform our international partners, that sort of thing. That did not happen. You know, this was in September, October of 2019, months before the Chinese admitted there was a problem. That says to me that issues of saving face within the Communist Party leadership outweighed any good sense about what was happening under their noses. And that falls directly into the lap of President Xi. I think also this way, Selwyn. Xi Jinping has been the leader of China, the president of China, since 2013. Under the old rules, the old constitution in the Communist Party, succession is to occur every 6 years. Mm. And he would have been replaced by the number two fellow in the CCP. Instead, he rigged the constitution, rewrote it, so now he's president for life. Think about the number two, the number three, the number four people in the Communist Party, people who are younger than him. Their aspirations to be the big boss have now been stymied so long as he is alive. He has purged leadership cadres of people who voiced discontent with his move to personalize his authority. And here's the telling point. Large institutional one-party authoritarian states, such as China, do not rely on personalities. They rely on the party as a vehicle for advancement and improvement. And so the personalization of the leadership, the personalization of rule in the person of Xi Jinping is anathema to the sort of bureaucratic logics that got China to where it is today. So I think there's something going on inside the CCP. And what Xi is doing, he's using nationalism, a sense of pride, both at home and abroad, to suppress his enemies within the party and to show strength abroad, a strength that, quite frankly, may not be as solid as you might think at first glance. In other words, he could well be a bit of a paper tiger.
Yeah, it could well be. One of the things that the People's Republic of China's foreign minister strongly put earlier this week, that China's interests are relating to defending what it perceives as its territory, which includes Taiwan, Hong Kong, and most of the border regions all the border regions that you mentioned, and that it will always seriously defend those areas where it believes that it is under threat. Now, I guess most countries fall into that kind of category or definition of their defence interests. It also said that it believed that foreign powers, namely the West and the United States led, were the ones that were applying pressure within the South China Sea, that their intentions aggravate the sensitivities of China in that respect. Now, once again, I'm paraphrasing, and this is what I took from the statement. And in recent episodes, we've talked about how Great Britain is having some strange flotilla that is going to be sailing down to southern climes through the South China Sea. You can get China's point in a sense that such manoeuvres from the West do aggregate its aggregate its sensitivities and its interests. So I'd just like to put that on the table as well. And before you respond, I'll just bring up a couple of comments that have come in with respect to New Zealand and Australia and New Zealand's interests that we were discussing some minutes ago. First off is one here. They're saying now both are on the same agenda. Now, what it's talking about there is New Zealand's political parties. Anne-Marie is making reference, and this isn't Anne-Marie Brady, this is Anne-Marie from the from Facebook, is speaking relating to the two main parties in New Zealand. And also she goes and expands a little bit more. National, Labour, Green and ACT are all in line. So that's perhaps a response that's coming from people that you spoke about in your response to those questions on New Zealand. That New Zealand's more centre-left or humanitarian constituencies are the ones that may have some opportunity to complain with respect to Australia and New Zealand. Paul, if I've misparaphrased your view on that, please let me know. Otherwise, we'll go to a transition. We'll go to the Israeli issue.
Sure. Let's... Anne is right. I mean, again, as I said before, there are legitimate critiques to be offered from the left about New Zealand's rapprochement with Australia and the United States when it comes to defense and intelligence issues. Perfectly legitimate. I accept them. I happen to think that the issue is a little more complex than many people understand, not denigrating anybody's, objection to those closer ties. The key here is that New Zealand, if it's to remain independent in its foreign policy, it can't tie its horse to the Australian cart on every single defence and security related issue.
It's a common sense position you're advocating there, isn't it? Okay, let's take a transition and we'll come back and we'll talk about the changes that are happening inside Israel. Paul, what we've got this morning, or overnight New Zealand time, is some changes with respect to a firming up of many parties to form a coalition to oust Israel's long-standing Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. We understand from reports, news agencies, including Al Jazeera and others, the BBC and also the United States, is expressions of this. They're all reporting that the Israeli opposition leader has informed the country's president that he can form a coalition government and move that would bring an end to the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 12 years of power. that the leader of the opposition represents a more centrist position. But to make this possible, we've got the far right, well-known former Israeli defense minister, Naftali Bennett, who has been most prominent in recent times speaking on the conflict that was raging between Israel and Gaza and those in the West Bank. It looks like they've cobbled together a party of which includes those on the left as well, those on the far right, as we've mentioned, those on the centre, and even an Arab party. Paul, what do you make of this? You've been watching this very closely. And what do you make of this move and this announcement? Once again, putting it to the president in Israel that an alternative coalition party has the numbers to govern. I'll just add on this for the audience that there's a 10-day period before they would be sworn in, where Netanyahu is still in power. And I've got to say that overnight, Netanyahu was talking about distancing from the United States' influence and Israel moving out in its own respective interests against Iran. And I'll just add that into the mix. Paul, what do you make of this whole situation?
Well, without being an expert on Israeli domestic politics, I think the key to success of what essentially is an Israeli never Trump movement. I mean, this is a marriage of convenience of people who have simply had enough of Netanyahu. That's the single unifying factor. But the key to success of this coalition is whether or not it behaves in a centripetal as opposed to centrifugal fashion. That is, will it coalesce around a core set of policies and leave some of the, you know, harder stuff further down the road once they've consolidated? Or will they immediately split apart and atomize around the very issues that should be left in the too hard basket until such a time as the coalition has coalesced? And I say that because the interests represented by these eight parties are so disparate, so antithetical. They have nothing in common except hatred of Netanyahu. I don't think they're going to last. I'll be surprised if they last 6 months. And then we'll have another election. But the good news will be Netanyahu will be out of the picture and maybe in prison by that time. Because once he has to step down, he loses his immunity from prosecution for the corruption charges that have been leveled against him. So we may have seen the back of Netanyahu, but we may not have seen the basis for stable governance anytime soon, given of the nature of the parties involved. Now, not trying to be completely cynical about this, the fact that you could have a centrist party and a far-right religious party agree to rotate the prime ministership.
With Naftali Bennett years, being first to leave.
Bennett will go first, and then, what is this, Yair Lapid, yes, is the head of the centrist party. He will take over in August 2023, I believe, so every 2 years. That's a good sign. It may be wishful thinking, but the fact that you even have an Arab party, you know, Ra'am, led by Mansour Abbas, that is interesting for both good and bad reasons. But I think the fundamental issue here, Selwyn, is that the Knesset, the parliament, is 120 seats.
Yeah.
And there are 9.1 million Israelis. Not all of them vote, but you get the idea. Here in New Zealand, we have 121 thereabouts for 5 million people. And so what's happened is the Israeli parliament is splintered into 25 different parties.
Yes, some of these in the coalition are like 7 members that bring it, very, very small amounts.
So here's the thing. You and I talked about this last week. We talked about leadership weakness leading to war and that sort of thing. It is institutional weakness in Israel that is the fundamental grounds for the instability that we are seeing. Because you've got all these, again, atomized, splintered parties forming coalitions or not forming. I mean, the Arab side of parliament is broken into 6 different parties.
What stands out to me, too, is whether or not those other parties can control the instincts, put it in that way, instincts of Naftali Bennett. We saw Naftali Bennett on Al Jazeera really pushing the envelope during the conflict some weeks ago, where he's basically saying, you know, it sounds a bit crude, but I'm paraphrasing once again down, but it's accurate, I believe, that basically they'll go after Hamas, and if people get in the road and children are killed, those questions were put to him, where he says, well, it's Hamas's problem. It's their responsibility, not ours. So he was right behind Netanyahu, right behind the effort to take as much ground of destruction in the Gaza Strip in particular, before perhaps the United States and the international community would rein it in. How on earth can some of those more moderate leaders that have to postpone their leadership aspirations to prime ministership for 2 years, while this guy who he is something else, you know, he's front footing, he's convinced of his efforts and his style, and he is, you know, many would say has every right to take those views to protect the Zionist call with respect to Israel. But it seems like he's not even prepared in many respects to enter a dialogue, of which Netanyahu was actually saying last week under the umbrella of the United States pressure that he was prepared to do. So where does that all go?
Well, let's also remember that he only has 7 seats in the Knesset. So as we've been talking, you know, he's a very small party. He's bad news in that he wants to annex the West Bank. You know, he's a settler. I mean, he's an occupier. But the idea here is he will have to moderate, given all the competing interests within this coalition. Now, Benny Gantz, who is Netanyahu's defense minister, will stay on as defense minister in this coalition.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so I'm not sure if that's bad or good, but here is the thing. We're not going to see any fundamental shift with regards to the Palestinian quote-unquote question under this coalition for the foreseeable future. We will not. What they will do is address domestic policy issues, bread and butter issues that are of concern to the Israelis, and they'll start with the COVID pandemic response, which is going well, but they've also had, you know, third wave surges and that sort of thing. The expectations for change will more than likely rest with the rotation in office to Lapid as prime minister. Then we may see some movement. But you know what's ironic about this is, and again, we alluded to this last week, the big winner in this conflict was Hamas.
Yeah.
The Palestinian, you know, you and I, you know, we weren't prescient because we read a lot, but this new generation of Palestinian youth have found themselves a cause that their parents had gotten tired and weary of. And although not a full-blown intifada, they're not going away. They have now, there's a resurgence of Palestinian pride, and that's associated with the Hamas fight back and not the feeble lapdog reaction of Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. Mm-hmm. So the irony here is that the common enemy of the Israeli right has been strengthened as a result of Netanyahu's last-ditch effort to turn a nationalist conflict into a rallying cry for his prime ministership. He did what he did. He cost a lot of innocents their lives, and he still got the boot from his own folk. Because let's remember that Bennett was on his side of the ideological ledger, and he turned around and stabbed him in the back. So yeah. I can see why Netanyahu's not happy with Bennett and has called him a traitor. But the hard fact is that with Netanyahu gone, things will change, but no time soon. And in the meantime, the Palestinian cause has been resurrected, but not by Fatah, but by Hamas. And at some point, someone in Israel in a leadership position is going to have to acknowledge that fact.
And in closing, Paul, do you believe that the wants of those on the streets of the West Bank, the streets of Gaza City and others, and the streets of Tel Aviv and other cities in the rural areas of Israel that aspire to human rights as, you know, the ideal. Do you think that's possible under this new coalition? Something to be achieved?
No, but simply because I think that this is a caretaker coalition that will, I think, you know, pull itself apart, and then we'll see elections in 6 months, maybe a year. And that'll get interesting. We'll see how Likud recoups without Netanyahu. But I think the hard fact is that a lot of the right-wing tilt in Israel, somewhat akin to what we've seen in the United States, but with its own particular characteristics, the right-wing tilt has been driven by recent immigrants, Orthodox Jewish immigrants from Russia, from Eastern Europe, and from the United States. You can be a Zionist without being a apartheid occupier. You can believe in the Jewish homeland and not oppress the Palestinians as a matter of course. But these people are, in fact, those type of folk. And they're the tail that's wagging the political dog in Israel these days. And they have to be reduced as a political force before Israeli politics starts addressing the basic, you know, physical security, but also emotional security of their people. Because a lot of the third, fourth, fifth generation Israelis, they just want to go about their lives peacefully. They don't want to take other people's territory. They want to find a path to coexistence, as difficult as it may be. And all of that is being usurped by the new arrivals who are basically trying to drive the Palestinians into the sea. They're a cancerous force in Israeli politics, and hopefully this coalition will serve, if not of itself, then as a leadway to, you know, a more reasonable and more moderate politics where these reactionary forces, if not purged, will be reduced in terms of their political power.
On that point, Paul, let's conclude the program for this week. And to those that have watched this live, thank you very much. And also to those that are seeing this or listening to it on demand, we welcome you back Thursday, New Zealand time, around midday next week, and we'll discuss some of the other big issues impacting in this region and also around the world. Until that time, stay safe. Thank you. Take care.